Guardian Unlimited.
Newsdesk is brought to you in association with Tycoon. Six businesses, one investor. Join Peter Jones on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on ITV1.
Hello, this is Tim Mabey with Newsdesk on Monday the 2nd of July. Police are making several arrests around Britain following a second bomb attack on Saturday at Glasgow Airport. We hear from correspondents in Scotland and London. The floods are still a problem in Worcestershire and Yorkshire. Martin Wainwright is asking questions about whether we were properly prepared. President Bush has invited Mr. Putin to his family home in an attempt to warm up Russian-US relations again, as Ed Pilkington reports. Zan Rice has been to the fabled city of Timbuktu to find out how they're trying to save their historic documents. But Matt Weaver and John Henley have been trying to find much more up-to-date artefacts for their contributions from today's papers and the Guardian diary. I am the only historic remain in the pod today. There was a second car bomb attack over the weekend on Glasgow Airport, but the only person hurt was one of the alleged bombers. At least five people have now been arrested across Britain, including a doctor and his wife, who were stopped by police on the M6. Police say that the terror threat of more attacks is critical. First, we go to Scotland, where our correspondent Severin Carell brought me up to date.
Well, what we now know is there were only two occupants of the vehicle. The police have ruled out completely there was any other people in the car. They've also confirmed, and we've had images showing this, that there were at least two, possibly more, propane gas cylinders in the vehicle, along with the petrol, which many, many eyewitnesses speak of seeing. We also know that the driver of the vehicle is the man who is currently critically ill in the Royal Alexandra Hospital in Paisley, and the passenger is a 27-year-old man of apparently of foreign birth. There's speculation that the driver, or at least one of the occupants in it, was an Iraqi, and we also understand that the police have been searching a house in a village called Houston, which is about 45 miles to the west of the airport, which had been rented out by a doctor, allegedly. And that doctor, we have been told by local sources, actually worked at the Royal Alexandra Hospital.
Now, Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist head, Peter Clark, was in Glasgow himself pretty quickly, and this is what he had to say.
In terms of the wider investigation, we are learning a great deal about the people who were involved in the attacks here in Glasgow and the attempted attacks in central London. The links between the three attacks are becoming ever clearer. We are pursuing many lines of inquiry, and I'm confident, absolutely confident, that in the coming days and weeks, we will be able to gain a thorough understanding of the methods used by the terrorists, of the way in which they planned their attacks, and of the network to which they belong. As always, I would urge the public to stay alert, and I shall repeat that which I have already said before, that public safety has always been, is, and will remain our top priority.
That was Peter Clark, head of Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist squad, speaking in Glasgow. Severin Carell again. The police did, in fact, suspect a Scottish connection even before the attack on the airport, didn't they?
Well, that's correct. We've also been told by local sources that the police were in touch with the owner and the company renting the property in Houston in the hours before the attack on the airport. In Saturday afternoon, they were trying to track down people that could give the police information about the identity of the people living at the house. What we don't know quite is whether or not the police were aware of their names or whether they had just tracked them using other kinds of technology such as the automatic number plate recognition technology.
And is Scotland pretty shocked that this sort of outrage should have come to their home?
Yes, they are. I mean, there's a point at which most Scots would have thought it would be inevitable that at some point something of this kind would happen. But up until now, Scotland has regarded itself as, immune is the wrong word, but certainly perceived abroad as being neutral within the UK context, that most people who wanted to make attacks against the UK would attack England and English targets, and in particular London. There have been occasionally, if you exclude Lockerbie, of course, nearly 20 years ago, minor incidents. I think there was a Republican attack on a bar in the west end of the east end of Glasgow, in the early 1970s. But apart from that, Scotland has been pretty much excluded from all previous terrorist incidents. At the most, say the Republican and Loyalist terrorists operating in Northern Ireland would use Scotland as a place for recruitment, a place for getting supplies, a place for resting up terror cells or for raising funds. But certainly they would never, ever commit atrocities in Scotland.
And have the Muslim community been concerned enough to sort of speak out against them?
Absolutely. The police, the Muslim community leaders, MPs and political leaders such as Alex Salmond have been absolutely uniform in their condemnation of what happened. They've been very, very quick to reassure everybody that this is not something that can be blamed or pinned on Scotland's Asian community or Scotland's Muslim community.
Severin Carell. Richard Norton Taylor is the Guardian's security editor. I put it to him that the police investigation was moving very fast.
Well, there'll be a number of people arrested, five or more now, I think, talking now in sort of mid-morning on Monday. Two people were found on the M6 motorway, weren't they? Or the police were alerted to two or three, but knowing where the cars were going was pretty fast, and then whether they had from them or their mobile phone numbers or any other way, they arrested quite a few people, didn't they, up north. The London connection is still assumed to be a London connection, i.e. a connection between the Glasgow attempted attacks and the London ones. But the other key question really is, well, how many more people they're going to find, and how many people do they think in the plot who they have not found? And we won't know that for some days, I suppose.
And why do they say that the threat is still critical?
Partly because they think someone who they don't know and cannot find or haven't found yet is out there, not only with a capacity to attack some target, but actually with intention of attacking the target. But they have general intelligence, or the assumption is made, because intelligence is an art, not a science, as we know, that someone is out there planning a fourth or third or fourth attack.
Richard Norton Taylor. With me now in the studio is Matt Weaver with today's papers clutched in his arms. So what are they saying about how the new government has coped with this sudden crisis?
Well, Gordon Brown seems to be coming out of it rather well. He's heaped with praise from some unlikely quarters, notably Janet Daly in The Telegraph. It has established the tone of his premiership as surely as the death of Princess Diana did for his predecessor, she says. All that famously dour ponderousness has looked absolutely appropriate, she reckons. And she says it augurs badly for the Tories under David Cameron. The last thing the electorate wants now is to be governed by a bunch of prancing fops.
crude.
Yeah, and the Independent contrasts the calm way that Brown responded to Tony Blair's hyperactive approach to terrorism. And it urges Brown not to rush through repressive anti-terror laws, as his predecessor had, and opt instead for a new, subtler approach. Even Trevor Kavanagh in The Sun praises Brown's magisterial approach, which he says is helping to stamp his authority on the public and is enough to make Tony Blair wince.
All about Brown rather than the new Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, I notice. Another disaster led to what was, in fact, quite an emotional and happy evening last night, the concert in aid of Princess Diana, or in memory of her.
Yeah, but the Guardian and the Telegraph are as cheeky as they dare to be about yesterday's events. It was all about nostalgia and carefully confected sentiments, says The Guardian. And The Telegraph says that the cheesiest songs got the biggest cheers. It adds that Princess William and Harry, who hosted the event, are unlikely ever to rival Ant and Dec.
And in many people in my family were saying that Rod Stewart can't actually sing anymore.
Well, it was Tom Jones covering the Arctic Monkeys, which brought the best out of The Guardian's music critics, Alex Petridis. He says that it was a catastrophe that should have caused a nationwide outpouring of misery to dwarf even those seen in August 1997. But of course, The Express loved it all. It was a terrific, outstanding success, and Diana would have been very proud of her son.
Well, quite unlike sort of popish festivals, there was no smoke to be seen anywhere because, of course, the smoking ban began yesterday.
Yeah, and that well-known puffer, Keith Waterhouse, writing in the Mail, is appalled by the ban. It would be an unimaginable evening, George Orwell's 1984, he moans. And the effect on pub life will be disastrous, he says, citing the rise in gastro pubs. And he asks, why are non-smokers so overbearingly bloody rude? Meanwhile, The Telegraph reckons that thousands of people defied the ban yesterday and councils have yet to issue any fines.
Well, I know. They've got enough to do, the police, haven't they, quite frankly, let alone the councils. There's one other rather curious story you've got about piranhas.
Yeah, do you remember that James Bond film where a woman gets dropped in a pool of piranhas and gets gnashed to bits? Well, it's all very unfair fare on piranhas, according to new research from the University of St Andrews. They don't actually do that. They're scavengers, not predators. And they hunt in shoals to avoid being eaten themselves. According to the Mail, most species of piranhas are vegetarians. And the meat eaters only graze on their prey by taking bites out of other fish rather than actually killing them.
I must confess, I'm pretty dubious, having been brought up in South America and warned never to go walking down any friendly-looking streams. That's Matt Weaver, and you can survive. You can survive if you can, but you can also read a full review of the papers every day by subscribing to our email service, guardian.co.uk/wrap. It's still pretty wet out there if you're unfortunate enough to live on the Welsh-English border or in Yorkshire. It's been going on for a week now, and there's still more heavy rain forecast, though perhaps not more floods. It was the wettest June in England since 1914. Those whose lives are going to be dominated by cleaning out their houses are asking questions about why the waters did so much damage. Is it that we've allowed homes to be built in flood-prone places without proper protection? Martin Wainwright reports from Arksay, near Bentley in South Yorkshire.
I'm with two local residents, Dennis Lowe and Tony Riley. Tony Riley sells carpets, so he's going to be a busy man. What we've been talking about is the very long-standing and complicated flood defence arrangements they've always been in this area, because Dennis, just I've got a little map here and it's covered with things saying drain, marsh and the rest of it. You're used to being near the water here.
Yes, definitely, yes. That's where the name Thorpe Marsh comes from, and the flood, it is a flood defence basically. The problem this time hasn't been so much the Don flooding, it's been the Ebeck.
Now the Ebeck is a little, well, normally a little stream, a beck, a Yorkshire word for a stream, which feeds into the Don?
Yes. It feeds into the Don all year round, providing it's not flooding. But it's engineered to stop going to the Don when it's too high, to take the overfill, as you might say.
And it's interesting because we sometimes think, you know, the rivers fill with all this rain and top their banks and dreadful, but they're actually very sophisticated arrangements, because there's a sluice gate where the Ebeck joins the Don, I gather, and that works in quite a clever way.
Yes, it's all on pressure. If the Don's low enough and the Ebeck's full, it'll force the gates open, it'll run into the Don, down the Hoos and out into the estuaries. Yeah. But if the Don's high, as it has been, it doesn't allow the sluice gates of the Ebeck to open. Therefore, it all backs up, and that's when it starts coming over into us.
This is what we can't understand with them. A few years ago, they wanted to build the landfill at Thorpe Marsh.
They're still trying.
Where does the rainwater and everything go if they fill this in?
Now, that's really interesting, because I think that's at the root, to some extent, of what's happened, because although there's been exceptional rainfall, which probably no system could completely defend against, we are messing around now, aren't we, with these old tried and tested drainage arrangements.
Well, what happens to what we've got now? If they do fill it, them questions have got to be answered first before the start.
The other thing I've noticed coming along here is a lot of new houses. Now, is that sensible in an area that's in a floodplain?
Not really, no. But money usually talks, doesn't it? Yeah. You know, the
people
that
all plans them.
But you've had one bit of good luck, haven't you? You were telling me this is very much a mining. It was very much a mining area, and the big pit here, Bentley, has closed now, and that's had a lucky effect, I gather.
Yeah. Because we were led to believe that the Overby shaft dome, the land has sunk into the minings, so creating a dish which will take water.
Martin Wainwright reporting. President Putin of Russia is in the USA for a quick visit, and he's been invited by President Bush to the family home at Kennebunkport in Maine, the first leader to have been taken there by Bush Jr. On the line now is our correspondent Ed Pilkington. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
So is it a special attempt by George Bush to remake a friendship, do you think?
Yeah, George Bush is rolling out his special weapon in the relationship with Russia, which is lobster and swordfish. And if that doesn't work in getting them back on track, nothing will. They've been getting on very, very badly, or successively badly, in recent months. And recently Putin alluded to the Bush administration as a new Third Reich. So that's a sort of indication of how bad things have got.
The big disagreement has been the US-NATO missile defence system, which will go right up to Russia's borders. Will the Americans give any ground on that, though?
No one expects anything solid to come out of these talks. He arrived last night and he'll be leaving this evening, Putin, to go on to Guatemala. And I don't think there's going to be any major announcement saying they've, you know, agreed this or that. What there will be is a chance just to sort of thrash it out and maybe clear the air a little bit. America wants to put missile defense posts up in the Czech Republic and Poland, which is, you know, too close for comfort for Russia. And Putin floated a wild card sort of alternative scheme in, for Azerbaijan, which I don't think the Americans will buy. So they're not going to come to any agreement on this. Maybe they just sort of clear the air a little bit.
What other issues do you think might get into the discussions?
Well, the two other big ones are Iran, where America is trying to tighten the screws on the on Tehran over its nuclear enrichment program. And it won't be able to do that if Russia blocks it using its veto in the United Nations. So we know that George Bush will raise Iran and invite Putin to join him in getting a bit tougher with the Tehran regime. And the other big one is Kosovo, which, with the UN's blessing, is moving towards independence. Now, Serbia fearsomely opposes that, and Russia, as ever, is standing beside Serbia. Again, the UN veto comes in here. Putin could wield it and could stop Kosovo becoming independent, and George Bush will want to tease him away from that position. And finally, the third thing is that both presidents want to know who's going to take over as president in the counter country. I mean, they quite like to know what's going to happen in their own country, but they're curious about the other. Unusually, both Putin and Bush will be having to step down soon. And in both cases, we have no clue about who will replace them.
This is Mr. Bush Sr.'s family home. Will the family be invited to meet Mr. Putin?
Well, it's kind of a weird event because poor old Putin gets two Bushes, two for the price of one. The actual event's being hosted by Bush Sr. Because it's, you know, he's head of the family and it is a family summer estate. So both Bushes were there to welcome him when he came off the helicopter. And Bush Sr. will be acting as host, so he's made clear he won't be sitting in any of the actual discussions.
Now, John Henley's here, or at least he isn't. So shall we just move on to Timbuktu? Righto. Timbuktu in Mali has a name from a fabled past, and once it was a famed city, but that's several centuries ago. It's no longer a city of wonder, but once scholars travelled there from across Europe and Africa, and that's why it has a surprising historical heritage. Many, many ancient manuscripts, as Zan Rice found at the end of a dusty journey.
When you reach the end of the world, which is how the near-mythical city of Timbuktu in Mali is often described, you find that the intense desert heat has sucked away the colour. Walking through the sandy streets, where young boys play football using plastic bottles, it is easy to feel disappointed at the lack of mystique. It's still hard to imagine that Timbuktu was once at the heart of the world's great empires, with a rich gold and salt trade and a vast centre of learning. But the evidence is here, and it's in ink on crumbling yellow paper. Hundreds of thousands of handwritten manuscripts dating back to the 11th century are scattered around Timbuktu and other desert villages. Some are in private libraries, others are packed in wooden trunks or buried beneath the sand. They cover topics as diverse as astronomy and botany, commerce and law, recipes for homemade aphrodisiacs, and the Quran. Experts say that these are some of the earliest examples of written history in sub-Saharan Africa, and that they dispel the myth that the continent's past was never documented. Late one evening, I took a motorcycle through the narrow streets to ask one of Timbuktu's best-known historians, Salem Ould El Haj, to tell me why the city produced so many manuscripts.
Timbuktu needed a lot of manuscripts because during the 16th century, there were 25,000 of students. So books were written, and people would come from all over the world to buy or to sell books. Nowadays, even though people from Timbuktu cannot express themselves very well in Arabic, they've conserved the manuscript in the same way England has conserved the Queen.
The most important work has been done at the Ahmed Barber Institute, named after one of Timbuktu's most famous scholars. The centre has collected 30,000 manuscripts from the region, including its showpiece, a copy of Islamic law dating to 1204. The South African government is spending £3 million on a new library to house the manuscripts in Timbuktu. Teams of local preservationists are building made-to-measure boxes to protect each document from the heat and dust. And in a painstaking exercise involving computers and scanners, every single fragile page is being transferred from the Middle Ages into the 21st century.
I am Mohamed Jagaite. I work with the Ahmed Baba Institute of Timbuktu. My work is concerned with cataloging the manuscript. So far, we've cataloged about 4,000 manuscripts and digitized 80,000 pages. Our main objective is to make what we call a virtual library online, reachable to any person in the world.
A short walk away from the Ahmed Baba Institute are two of Timbuktu's most impressive private libraries. The Mamahadra Library, run by Abdul Qadir Hydra, is a smart building with 9,000 manuscripts. Mr. Hydra spent many years collecting manuscripts on behalf of the Ahmed Baba Institute. He told me one story about some orphans who had inherited a valuable cache of manuscripts.
Je lui demande est-ce qu'on peut ouvrir voir ce qui est dans le caisse.
And I asked him if possible to open and see what is inside. Really.
Il a accepté.
He accepted.
On a fait sortir la caisse.
We took out the case.
On l'a ouvert.
We opened it.
On a trouvé que tout ce qui est dans le caisse était mangé par les termites.
We found that everything was almost eaten by the termites.
Fearful of outsiders taking their hugely prized treasures away, many keep them hidden, sometimes burying them underground. Before dawn one morning, I drove for 2 hours through the desert from Timbuktu to Bir, a small, mainly Tuareg village, to meet Fida Ag Mohammed. He led the way to a small, mud building with a corrugated iron door. On a table inside sat half a dozen ancient-looking leather-bound books and pouches. Opening a small pouch to reveal a thick wad of yellow pages, 1300s, he said, matter-of-factly. He is seeking funding to build a small library to conserve his collection. Mahmoud Muhammad Doudad, an expert on manuscripts in Timbuktu, says that such is the value of the knowledge kept in these brittle pages, the help cannot come soon enough.
Every single day, every minute, there is a part of manuscript that is cut down and lost.
That report by Zan Rice in The Fabled Timbuktu. Equally fabled, of course, is John Henley, who is now here with his diary Look Ahead. Have the listeners been good to you with sending you lots of extraordinary tales?
As ever, Tim. Yes. Now I come into a veritable avalanche of entertaining stories on a Monday morning. But we did start, I think, today with an urgent travel advisory. This is for anyone thinking of going anywhere in the company of BBC executive Helen Borden, who was quoted over the weekend on the BBC website as being one of the eyewitnesses, a prime eyewitness to the terrorist attack on Glasgow Airport, and if you search through the BBC archives, it appears that she was also on that Virgin train, actually on that Virgin train that derailed in Cumbria last February. So watch out if you're thinking of going away with her. She clearly takes trouble with her. Over to dailyindia.com, which is reporting that a booze-gloving goat is terrorising the township of Varanasi. Goat in Varanasi has been found to relish liquor, chicken and fish, it says. Residents maintain that the goat was set free and is surviving on food and alcohol provided by drunkards. The goat has been set loose by its owner for a wish to come true, an eyewitness tells the paper. It now drinks liquor at the riverbank, consumes chicken as well as fish, and if it doesn't get what it wants, it starts attacking. So be warned, anybody over there. Now, Tim, I'm sure you, like most of us, remember your childhood as a goat. Golden age of innocence. Things were so much better back then. People spoke to one another. You know, you could leave your door unlocked at night. You used your jumpers for goalposts. Nobody nicked them, that sort of stuff. Well, Richard Madeley apparently agrees, as he recalled on his fine Tea Time TV show the other day. In my day, said Richard, nobody carried knives. They just roughed you up a bit and then took your wallet. Don't we all long for that golden age of gentle mugging? And finally, we may be asking the question that... Whether anybody else finds it a bit hard to believe that we now have a government of all the talents when Harriet Harman has six of the jobs.
Today's edition of Newsdesk was produced by Phil Maynard. Don't forget our special sports podcast this week. Formula One from the French Grand Prix is there on the site now, and also our Wimbledon special. Thanks for listening to Newsdesk. I'm Tim Mabey, but Matt Wells will be in this seat tomorrow.
Newsdesk is brought to you in association with Tycoon. Six businesses, one investor. Join Peter Jones on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on ITV1.
Guardian Unlimited.